and always she would tell my grandfather in the morning, I dreamed of Jack, and he would bear it. And the tantrums, and the screaming, and the rages that blew up from nowhere and then evaporated. He bore it all, while she doted on him in her strange, harsh, passionate way. They were together more than 40 years. I'm the same build as my grandmother. I look much the same as she did at my age. Another unwomanly, angular perfectionist. And maybe she helped to make me self-employed, to keep my own hours, and to always own my workplace, not just borrow it in the small hours. And my house is full of wood, of finishes and waxes and grains. Only one thing in the place is French polished, a table. I did it myself, and thought of her shaking her head at me all the while.
My summer job with Grandma in the Woodwork Shop was written and presented by A.L. Kennedy and produced by Mark Smalley. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Martin Handley, and to tonight's BBC Prom live on Radio 3. This is already the BBC Symphony Orchestra's fifth concert this season, but the first to which the orchestra has been able to welcome back its conductor laureate, Andrew Davis. The main work in the second half is Brahms' magnificently defiant Fourth Symphony. Before it, though, we hear the first performance at the BBC Proms of the elegy Hubert Parry wrote on hearing of Brahms's death. Parry, like Elgar, didn't really look like a composer, perhaps a military man with a nautical jauntiness. He did like sailing boats, but anyway, he looked like someone rather conventional. Actually, he was naturally unconventional. And as Parry expert Jeremy Dibble and Parry's great-granddaughter Laura Ponsonby told me earlier at the Proms intro over the road at the Royal College of Music.
He was crazy. He played all these extremely dangerous sports. I mean, often he was laid up at Eton, you know, knocked unconscious during these games of fives or whatever they play. And, I mean, he played everything, absolutely put his back into whatever he did. Of course, this is the story of his life, really. Mm. But yes, he was a keen sportsman. I mean, even later in his life, he used to like to go to the varsity matches, cricket, rugby. And so on, yeah.
But he did things like sort of sailing his yacht in a storm and then jumping off it.
Yes, he did. That's absolutely right. He only liked his yacht if it was really stormy. Anything he did, I know my grandmother, who was devoted to him, said he, you know, even a car drive, he preferred it when the weather was terrible. Mm. And I know he said about one of his trips on the yacht, it was calm, we had no fun at all.
Hubert Parry's granddaughter, great-granddaughter, I should say, Laura Ponsonby. And his affinity with gloomy weather ran deep. His daughter also said that some days his whole being would become clouded as if he was battling with some deep inner pain. Vaughan Williams was a pupil. He recalled Parry as having a very nervous temperament. Also, he was, from his early days right down to the end of his life, a very deep thinker, both on music and on other subjects, so said VW. Parry admired Brahms more than any other composer, perhaps because of the musical restraint he saw in him he would like to have had himself. And Brahms' death, a huge blow to Parry. As director of the Royal College of Music, he addressed the students about Brahms' importance, not just as a musician, but as someone who he regarded as sincere, honest individual and full of personal conviction. The grief-stricken Parry freed himself of his other commitments so he could compose a piece in Brahms' memory, but try as he might, he couldn't finish it by the day of the commemoration concert at the college. Maybe it was more of a private tribute anyway, so it was perhaps appropriate it was first played at Parry's own memorial concert after his death in 1918, when his colleague and erstwhile rival Stanford took the score down from Parry's shelves and revised it for performance. It may be called elegy, but it's not only a very personal, but a very passionate expression of feeling. Moments which recall Brahms, but almost as many which are Wagnerian, the two great opposing musical figures of the day exerting an equal influence on Parry's psyche. So now here once again comes Andrew Davis to conduct the BBC Symphony Orchestra in Parry's Elegy for Brahms.
Thank you.
mystical resolution at the end of Parry's Elegy for Brahms, which has just been given its first performance at the BBC Proms by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Andrew Davis. Somehow appropriate that it was played for Parry himself at the memorial concert for him, in a sense, original, passionate, brooding. Well, to end tonight's BBC Prom, music by the man Parry so revered, Brahms. And Parry would surely have been overwhelmed by Brahms's Fourth Symphony. Andrew Davis likes it too.
It is my favourite Brahms symphony. I know we're all conductors are supposed to say their favourite Brahms symphony. There's one they're conducting at the moment, but I have to say Brahms 4 is my favourite.
Well, Brahms kept his symphony secret from even his closest friends while he was composing it. And after he'd finished it, he wrote to one of them, "Shall I send you a piece of me, and have you the time to look at it and report? In general, pieces by me are unfortunately more pleasant than I am myself and require less correction. But in this area, the cherries do not grow ripe and sweet to the taste. If you do not like the thing, do not hesitate to say so. I'm not anxious to write a bad number 4. Brahms made the same rather disparaging comments when he was trying to persuade his friend Hans von Bülow to let him give the first performance with his orchestra in Meiningen. Despite the rather strange selling technique, he also suggested the symphony wouldn't get much of an audience. Von Bülow gave Brahms the go-ahead and returned from listening to a rehearsal to note, "Number 4, stupendous, quite original, quite new, individual and rock-like, breathes incomparable energy from start to finish." And some years earlier, Brahms had discussed with von Bülow the idea of a symphonic movement based on a version of the Chaconne in Bach's Cantata 150. In his Fourth Symphony, Brahms uses the theme as the basis for his Passacaglia with 32 variations, which forms the arresting tragic finale. And before it comes Brahms' only symphonic scherzo, a movement with enough energy and power to function as a finale itself. Can't help telling that Hubert Parry would have liked it, that this first Proms performance of his Elegy for Brahms, the Fourth Symphony by the great man, was played after it. And here comes Andrew Davis once again to conduct the BBC Symphony Orchestra in Brahms' Fourth Symphony.
Thank you.
Brahms' Fourth Symphony, ending with defiant magnificence, music full of power, lyricism and compassion. Played to end is BBC Brahm by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, led by Stephen Bryant, and conducted by its conductor laureate, Sir Andrew Davis. Some of Brahms' friends may have had their doubts about the piece, but when they first heard it in a two-piano version, when the composer conducted its first performance in Meiningen and took it on tour, it was very warmly received. Only in Vienna were there problems. Some of the reviews were extremely hostile. It was only a few weeks before Brahms' death when a performance finally won the Viennese round and became the focus of a great outpouring of affection for him, his last appearance in public. Andrew Davis back on the platform, bringing the woodwinds to their feet, led by flautist Michael Cox, oboist Richard Simpson, clarinetist Catherine Lacey, bassoonist Julie Price. And that was for the horns, principal horn Martin Owen. And the brass going to their feet. Huge roar, principal percussionist, principal timpanist, I should say, John Chimes. And the strings. Well, don't forget, if you've missed some of tonight's prom, I would like to listen again. You can always do so. Just go to the website, bbc.co.uk/radio3. Select proms and pick prom 31. And it'll be broadcast again on Radio 3 next Friday afternoon at 2. Tomorrow's a double prom day, triple if you include lunchtime at the Cadogan Hall. First one starts at 7. First evening concert gives you the chance to compare youth orchestras. After the National Youth Orchestra Symphonie Fantastique yesterday evening, tomorrow, the European Union Youth Orchestra Matthias Bammer to tackle more Berlioz. Also in the programme, Tchaikovsky and Janacek. And in 10 in the late night prom, the BBC Radio 3 World Roots Academy in Music from Iraq. So another very full day at the BBC Proms, all live here on Radio 3. But for the moment, as Andrew Davis returns to the platform here in the Albert Hall, time for me to hand you on to Jonathan Swain at Broadcasting House for the rest of your Radio 3 evening.
Martin, thank you. Martin Handley there at the Royal Albert Hall. And just to say, if you'd like to submit a review of tonight's prom, then just go to bbc.co.uk/proms and click on share. Well, in 13 minutes' time tonight, our Sunday feature, After a Dance Maker Dies. With the deaths over the past years of choreographers Merce Cunningham and Pina Bausch, the Sunday feature asks whether modern dances can and should survive the deaths of their makers. That's at 10 o'clock tonight. Until then, following on from the finale of Brahms' Fourth Symphony, a little more music inspired by Bach. Few musicians forge a link in people's minds with one work more than pianist Tatiana Nikolaeva did with the Shostakovich Preludes and Fugues for piano. It was Nikolaeva's playing of Bach's 48 Preludes and Fugues which inspired Shostakovich to write his own set. He only went round the keys once, 24 to Bach's 48, but what an extraordinary tribute they are. As Nikolaeva put it herself, a new word in polyphony. She'd been then at the start of the tribute in early 1950s Moscow when she was in her 20s. She went round to Shostakovich's flat every day. There was another prelude and fugue, she said, and they worked on them together. Well, here she is recorded in 1990 in number 16 in B-flat minor. Thank you. Shostakovich, inspired by Bach. Number 16 in B-flat minor from Shostakovich's 24 Preludes and Fugues, played there by the Russian Tatiana Nikolaeva. It's 10 o'clock and now on BBC Radio 3, the Sunday feature. Last summer, two important modern choreographers died. Both were modern dance makers who'd been hailed as pioneers and great artists, but now their works and their companies hang on threads. Francis Burns asks, can a modern dance work survive the death of its maker in After a Dance Maker Dies?
So these are the notes for Pictures, which was my first dance. Yeah.
Someone's reading a dance.
LIF walks, number 30. So Lise Friedman, those are her initials, is walking in, doing phrase number 30. AG, that's Alan Good, is walking at the same time as her. He's doing phrase number 21. I remember the piece so well. So phrase number 30 is a slow walk in releve fourth, and Alan's phrase was a walk on flat foot.
But this logbook of stick men and shorthand is a choreographer's notebook. It isn't the dance itself. No score or script can give us a dance.
I was the new person in the company at the time, so it would be a while. Here I am. PL, step on left.
Merce Cunningham said, you have to love dancing to stick to it. It gives you nothing back. No manuscripts to store away, no paintings to show on walls and maybe hang in museums, no poems to be printed and sold, nothing but that fleeting moment when you feel alive. Last summer, after 90 years of life, during which he'd made about 200 dances and been called a genius, he died in New York. The fleeting moment over, can his masterwork survive? Twenty-seven days before Merce, another seminal dancemaker had died, suddenly in Wuppertal in Germany, Pina Bausch. I never considered going to see Merce Cunningham's grave in New York. There's something here that really suits Pina. A grave overlooking a pond in the woods, which is all smoky. And moving. And of course, beside me, her changing body. Both Merce Cunningham and Pina Bausch made original worlds out of movement. I'd say Merce was of the air and Pina of the earth. The work of Cunningham is like lines that light makes in water. Pina's dancers get drenched or quenched or reborn in it. Most dance works have been lost. Of course, flimsy things disintegrate, superficial works cloy, earnest things bore. But what about the most revelatory of our modern dancers? Surely dancegoers who thrive on a sense of possibility and loss, always in hope of the numinous moment, do want another few seasons of Biped, Summer Space, Beach Birds, Nelken, Bausch's Rite of Spring, before they join the long list of the lost or, like Nijinsky's Rite of Spring, myth.
Dance is an activity. Unless it's done, unless it's dealt with, it doesn't exist. Then it becomes a memory or a photograph or a videotape.
The most immediately bereaved are the dancers. Typically for pioneers of modern dance, both Cunningham and Bausch founded companies which were named after them and danced only their works. They first choreographed for their own bodies, and their dancers often seem cast in their likeness. So the death of these choreographers is a particular crisis.
Is everybody here?
On the notice board of the Cunningham Studios in Manhattan, I saw a list of rules by John Cage, Merce's partner and collaborator. One rule says, always follow the leader.
All right, let's take places.
Robert Swinston is setting his watch to time a run-through.
All right, position.
He performed for Merce for 30 years,
go.
The last 17 of which he was also his assistant.
Curtain coming up.
Merce's picture is up on the wall, and his desk is still there, and we have another picture of him there. We have plants and flowers there, and we light candles when we work. Of course, we miss him. You know, he was a leader. I'm very similar to him in a way. We call it studio rat, that we come to the studio every day. This is our home and where we work. The daily work, the process is really our life. It's our lifeblood. So I'm trying to figure out a way to maintain the Cunningham studio, to teach Merce's technique, and also to teach his repertory.
Close. Either first or fifth back. Do you remember what you did? Did you close fifth?
It feels like fifth, but I can't say.
So I think so. Close fifth back and twist, holding the arms. Brush the left leg side with the arms going side high straight. Close fifth back.
To pass Merce's work on to this generation and then the next generation, and hopefully then this generation who's learning it now can develop their experience and take it to the three or four generations forward. This is how you pass dance from one generation to the other.
Have you ever considered just letting the dance evaporate?
I never considered that. Of course, I'm devoted to his work. I mean, dance should be seen. Dance is dance is a verb.
Pina Bausch forged theatre works out of material her dancers fed her, intimacies about trying to connect with each other and the world. She absorbed the dancers into her body, and they absorbed her.
Okay, quiet, please, we start.
Josephine Ann Endicott, who's Australian, joined Bausch's Wuppertal Tanztheater in 1973, the year it began.
You gave so much of yourself. You gave so many feelings to her. Sometimes I thought, I am her feelings. I've always wanted to leave that company, but now that she left us first, I've always wanted to have short hair. Not always, but over the last 10 years, because when you get over 50, people say old people shouldn't have long hair, but Pina wanted always Joe with long hair. I got a pair of scissors, and I took this part of my hair, the fringe, and started cutting. I had this in my hand. The tail of my handy rang. It was actually one of Pina's assistants. And the call was, Joe, Pina is dead. The scissors fell to the floor. I let the hair down and I couldn't cut any longer. So this, I don't know, it's a very bizarre connection to her through my hair. And I wanted to cut it and I was one chop away. And then that phone rang, so it's something very bizarre. I thought to myself, oh, now I can be free of her, now I can be free. And the next morning, I walked down to the beach, to the sea, and I started to swim into this big sea, and I started crying in the water and calling out, Pina, Pina.
I bring you back to a very practical question.
Yeah.
Who inherited the dancers?
The rights and all of that has the son of Pina, Rolf Solomon Bausch.
And does that matter? Will that affect things?
No, I don't think so. He will try and do what he thinks is right and what's best for the company. I don't know, he's maybe 24. It's a very nice boy, man, now. Yeah, we are in his hands. They have a Stiftung, a foundation. We're seeing, we're going from week to week, from month to month, and learning by doing.
Pina died without a will. there were no formal plans in place for her succession. While her family will organise memory of her work, it's her dancers who embody it. They're going to keep the company going. Dominique Mercy is now the Tanz Theatre's co-director.
I think we have the duty to keep her work alive, because we are the one which still have it somehow in our blood and brain and spirit somehow, and it's very fragile.
In contrast, the Merce Cunningham Company is going to close. Can you really separate the dancer from the dance? Nancy Umanoff of the Mark Morris Dance Group shares the dance world's shock at the news about Cunningham's company.
This two-year tour that they're doing right now is the last chance that anybody will get to see Merce's dances on the dancers that he trained. Sort of, you know, it's the essence of what makes the work great on that company. Lots of companies can do Merce's work, but it's not quite the same. And that's why it's so important to see the work now, to see it the way that Merce intended it on the bodies that he trained. And so, you know, the question is, can the work stand up when it loses that? That's, I think, a big question that a lot of choreographers deal with when they make a decision about whether their work will live beyond them.
After an international tour, the last performance of the Merce Cunningham Dance Company will be on New Year's Eve next year, 2011. This legacy plan had Merce's blessing. He'd said he wanted his work to last in some way, but wouldn't say how. So his staff consulted widely. He'd started the company so he could create, experiment, and perform. That wouldn't be relevant when he died. He should, the advice came back, plan to shut his company and license his works to other dance groups.
The days of having a full company of 15 dancers and being able to maintain them throughout the year is definitely over. I mean, I've given up trying to hold on to that idea. You can understand, this certainly is not my ideal, but I've had to accept it and try to do the best I can with it.
It's just that there's this strange picture that I have in a few years that it will be possible to see these fantastic works danced not by you, but
well,
danced by other people.
We'll be responsible for staging those pieces, for sure. But yes, we won't be able to do that. Unless, of course, somebody comes to us and says, well, we'd like you to organize a group to do this dance and take a tour. I mean, that's always a possibility, too. What do they call them? Revival. You know how these rock bands get together and do those things? Well, I mean, right now, I'm just worried about holding on to the studio, to tell you the truth.
How difficult is that? How much is that?
Well, it's expensive. Let's just speak in those terms.
In Germany, money hasn't forced the issue. The city of Wuppertal has committed for now to fund the Tanztheater at the same level as before Pina died, and three-year contracts had anyway just been signed. In America, though, it's mostly making new work that brings in the money. Trevor Carlson is the executive director of the Cunningham Foundation.
The question about a dance company that does not produce new work, an organization that exists in a single artist's name, with the knowledge, and we had this knowledge, Merce was quite clear about this, he wasn't interested in having other choreographers work on his dance company. So with all of those things in place, and the knowledge that a great amount of support that the company receives is garnered through the creation of new work. So we would lose that avenue. You become a touring museum of dance.
Things can go wrong when a company tries to exist on the personality and vision of one dead dance maker. Martha Graham was perhaps the most high profile of contemporary dance pioneers in America. She died in 1991. This summer, I saw her company perform political solos made by Graham and her contemporaries during the 1930s. The programme was called Dance is a Weapon, The solos were authentic, interesting, worthwhile, and the dancers committed. But there's a difference in style between preservation and revival. And I was surprised by their loss of confidence in the audience. The material was presented with voiceover and film archive and introduced like a lecture demonstration. Jacqueline Bulness dances with the company.
They're trying to bring a different audience, or even trying to educate the audience on Martha Graham and what she was trying to say in her work. Because, unfortunately, nobody really knows about Martha Graham, not many people. We teach them. I guess we're really trying to survive without money and with an audience that has no idea what we're putting out there. It's really sad because the audience members, they'll say, hey, I've never seen this before. I had no idea. Who is Martha Graham?
Who is Martha Graham? She made a whole new physical language for the passions called contemporary dance.
The only way for me to dance is if it means something, if it's emotional. And this work is so powerful in so many ways. My fourth year of high school, my senior year of high school, was a very difficult year for me. My mother passed away, and I found the power in the movement expressed the pain that I was feeling.
What about seeing her work performed? Can you remember when you first saw it performed, perhaps by the company?
I was just blown away. I mean, I got chills. I'm getting chills right now just thinking about the moment, but they did not lose their focus for a second.
Had any other companies had that effect on you, or any other choreography?
Pina Bausch. I always did want to dance for Pina Bausch, you know.
There was a battle between the administration and the dancers after Martha Graham's death that had a serious impact on the survival of her dance works. The company closed while the ownership of the dancers was debated. The courts wrested them back for the company. Disputes about how a dance is best served by its inheritors can bog a dance down. George Balanchine's will divided his ballets up between 13 or 14 legatees, splitting the rights three ways: American rights to one legatee, foreign to another, media to another. When he died in 1983, Barbara Horgan, his former PA, inherited one-third of the rights to 75 of his ballets.
It was a menu for disaster. I was extraordinarily fortunate in having a very close friend who was a lawyer. His name is Paul Epstein, and that name should be in the mind and on the lips of every choreographer, because he put together this idea of a trust, and there were three heirs who had the most intellectual properties. And we decided to put our rights into this trust and then go to the other heirs and ask them if they would like to put their rights into trust. Anybody who went into the trust had complete authority on their ballets. They could say yes, they could say no. But if they said yes, and the trust licensed that ballet on their behalf, they would receive the income immediately. So the legacy just sort of fell into place. And the other thing about legacy is supply and demand. People wanted his ballets.
Merce Cunningham, paying attention to these precedents, formed his own trust, which now owns and licenses his dance works. But when you hire a dance, what do you hire? The Cunningham Company are making dance capsules, online memory boxes for 50 of Merce's 200 works. Notice three-quarters of his dancers will have gone just like that. When a new company hires a work, a stager, an experienced Cunningham dancer, will reconstruct the dance with the help of the material in the capsules. Patricia Lent is in charge of licensing the dancers.
The key issue is, do we have any kind of video record? Without a videotape where we can see the dance, it's very, very difficult to imagine bringing it back. Merce's notes are extremely useful and extremely rich, often in his dances, he would start off with a certain number of phrases, typically 64, that number coming from the I Ching. And he would make 64 phrases, and there would be a notebook that had the 64 phrases immediately for a stager. That is probably the most useful. That tells you what Merce walked into the studio intending to say to the dancers. Then there's also a notebooks that have his plan for the structure of the dance. And that's where there are echoes of how he used chance procedures. So, for example, presumably using chance, he's figured out that phrase number 23 and 17 and 1 will be in section 1. There's also notebooks that are clearly the notebook that he carried into rehearsal over the course of the weeks of working with the dancer. So you can see timings, changing an entrance or changing an exit, who's doing which phrases. But in and of themselves, it's difficult to reconstruct a dance purely from the notes. The way that I think of it is that the notes are, in a sense, the plan for the dance, and the videotape is a record of what happened. I've always thought that the videotape that I would most like to have, it's not the rehearsal tape that's made the moment the dance is done. If it could exist, it would be a performance tape from a year later with the original cast. Because as you grow into the dance and learn to put it on stage, certain adjustments have to be made and you grow into the movement. So that would be the videotape that I would most like to have.
If it's on video, how can we call a dance ephemeral? Well, apart from the fact that video disintegrates after 20 years unless tenderly attended to, each video is partial. It shows just one version of the dance and we don't know which one. In Wuppertal, the Bausch performers try to overcome this by running films of up to 4 different performances on VT machines around the rehearsal hall. But which is it? At the Cunningham Studios, Robert Swinston is reviving Mercer's Pondway with Cunningham dancers. He's just taught them a jump which has contrarily hard arm and leg combinations. The difficulty is what these dancers are laughing at and struggling with. So they look at the original cast in rehearsal on a 1997 videotape. But what good is that? Should they be copying the way most of the dancers, one by one, don't do the almost impossible jump? Should they presume they had permission not to try?
No, I know.
Or should these dancers now all try to do it the way the final man on the video does, and beautifully?
Yeah, that person did it. Tom Cayley did it. I'm doing it.
The tape's almost meaningless without the memory of someone who was there.
What's very useful in approaching a dance, if you have been in it, is not necessarily that you remember every step, but you have a sense of how the dance worked, whether rhythm was particularly important at that time, whether Merce was talking about falling a lot at that time, whether the dance had a warmer feeling. It felt like you were more alone in the space.
If the choreographer was there with them today, he or she might decide to change it.
Do you want us to do that sidearm, Robert? Because we were doing this, but they're doing that.
Okay, yeah, do that.
Because keeping a dance alive is a continual process.
Turn the arm out.
They're showing
that. Okay, so let's clarify this.
Can process continue? Wuppertal Tanze Theatre, Pina revived pieces every year. She recast the roles. Not all new casts had the same combination of gifts as the originals, so she would then split the roles themselves apart to give one scene to one dancer, another to another, according to their skills, to keep all the dance work at its original pitch. But what the dancers could take from the creator is harder for her deputies. Dominique Mercy.
It's not easy because we have to cope with different personality and sensitivity from each dancer, which Pina had to do, but she was Pina. But I wanted to say, I feel free to do those things because through the responsibility we have, that the piece looks fidèle. You speak any French?
Faithful.
True. True. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I imagine that Pina, because she's the creator, had some
extra right to drag extreme.